அனைவருக்கும் எங்களது காலை வணக்கங்கள். இன்று லைஃப் டிவைன் வெப் மீட்டிங் நடக்கிறது. போன மாதம் பேசின அதே டாபிக் தான், இன்டிட்டர்மினன்ஸ், காஸ்மிக் டிட்டர்மினேஷன் அண்ட் இன்டிட்டர்மினபிள் பார்ட் டூ. மிஸ்டர் கேரி ஜேக்கப்ஸ் அவர்கள் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். ஐ எம் இன்வைட்டிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி டு ஸ்டார்ட் திஸ் ஸ்பீச்.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. This is our second session on indeterminates, cosmic determinants, and the indeterminable. For a long time, I thought that this chapter was indeterminable, which means that it was beyond comprehension. We started studying this chapter about 20 years ago, and now revisiting it after a long time in preparation for these talks, I think the chapter is really very simple. This long title of this chapter is meant to ask a basic question. What's going on in this world we live in? And why are things the way they are? And why do things happen the way they do? We've spent, I don't know how many, almost 2.5 years on book one. 28 chapters, and I think there were about 30 talks. Yeah? Book one seems to me very easy because he's talking about what we don't know. He's talking about the divine, he's talking about the absolute. So if he tells us that the absolute is Satchitananda and supermind is like this, we have nothing in our experience to contradict it. At least I don't. Maybe some yogi who has gone and achieved moksha feels, no, it's not like that. I've been to Nirvikalpa Samadhi and it's different than that. It's not what you described. Maybe for him it's a problem. For me, I don't have any problem when he says that the ultimate reality is Satchitananda, and he explains it. But in book two, he's not talking about that. He's talking about this. Especially in part one, where we are now just starting. This is the title of part one is The Infinite Consciousness and the Ignorance. We know he told us about the infinite consciousness. Now he's telling us about the ignorance. What is this ignorance? Why is it the way it is? We don't have any trouble, I think, agreeing that it's ignorant and that we're part of the problem. I think we have enough sense to know that's true. But what is this ignorance? Why is it the way it is? And what does it have to do with the infinite consciousness or Satchitananda is the real question. Why are things the way they are? Why do things happen the way they do? What is really determining the reality? We may say, okay, I mistake. Okay, I'm ignorant. Oh, I was egoistic. I was selfish. I was doing all of those things. All of that's fine, and that's good that we have that knowledge. But why are things the way they are? Why are they not different? This is the subject of this chapter. And of the next 13 chapters after this, in which he's going to explain to us the ignorance backwards and forwards, top side and bottom side. We're going to look at it from inside and outside until there can be no doubts. But in this chapter, he has one central message. The origin of the ignorance is Satchitananda. And the true nature of the ignorance is the evolution of a concealed, hidden Satchidananda to manifest itself. That's his statement. That is the fundamental principle. But still, it leaves many, 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 many questions unanswered. And he's going to address most important of them here. Last time, we reviewed the first half of the chapter, roughly half of the chapter. And he talked about different theories of creation, different theories for why the world is like as it is, why life is as it is today. One hypothesis that's been pursued by science is that really everything is a question of chance. Not like there's any divine plan. It's not like there's any divine planning. Everything is ultimately a question of chance. When we go out on the street, if a car is coming and swerving this way or that way, or we see somebody laughing or somebody crying, it all has nothing to do with us. It just is life. If it happens to rain or happens to be extra hot or power cut comes or anything else comes, it's all a question of chance. And a scientist has been studying chance for a long time. The problem with chance is, supposing I have a deck of 52 playing cards and I take them and I throw them out in the room, what is the chance that those cards may land and create a building? Or even half of those cards, what is the chance that they will arrange themselves in perfect order? Or they'll be sorted into the four suits in equal piles. The problem with chance is when we look at the world, there's too much of order. There's too much of regularity here for things to be chance. Because if chance were really the creator of the universe, we would have chaos. Now, sometimes when we go out on the road, it feels like chaos, I agree. But we know it's not chaos, because even with all the swerving traffic and mobs of people, somehow most everybody gets home safely. Even though it looks dangerous, somehow we manage. There's some order, there's some rule, there's some regularity there, even in the confusion, and things tend to work out. There's too much of order here, whether we look at the material elements or we look at society. When Collins wants to go and introduce himself to Darcy at the dance, what does he come up with? He's suddenly faced with a law. What's the law? Lizzie says, no, you cannot introduce yourself to Darcy. Unless he wants to meet you, you cannot introduce yourself. Who created this law? Who created this order that says that a clergyman cannot go and introduce himself to a rich man? But everybody knows the law. And everybody except Collins obeys the law also. So there's order there. There's an order in nature we see everywhere. We know what time of year the plants are going to grow, where they're going to grow, where they won't grow, what nutrients they need, how many hours sleep we need at night, what time the sun is going to rise tomorrow morning and next year or 6 years from now. There's so much of order and regularity. So chance cannot be the sole and real creator of the universe. So science has come up with an alternative hypothesis. There is law. There is a fixed law in nature that's determining everything. And science has been studying for the last 300-400 years, especially since the time of Newton, what those laws are. Why is it that year after year after year, day after day, the sun is going around, the sun is not going around, we are going around the sun, the planets are going around the sun in a fixed orbit. You can predict exactly where the Earth and the Sun are going to be 50 years from now on this day. And if you have the instruments and the computer, you can know what time the sun is going to rise. For us, rise 50 years from now on this day or any day, because there's a regularity and order in nature. The problem with the laws of nature is, if everything is according to a fixed law, there are a number of problems. First of all, who created these laws? Where did they come from? Why are things the way they are? Why is it that water freezes at 0 degrees and boils at 100 degrees? Why is it that everything behaves? Why is it that the bee is going and pollinating the flowers? Very convenient for the flowers. But why is it? Who's created these laws? They're not self-evident. Why is it that sugar tastes sweet? If you look at actually what sugar is, it's only a bunch of hydrogen and carbon atoms put together. Hydrogen is tasteless and invisible. Oxygen is, you have some oxygen there, carbon, they're all tasteless, invisible gases. Why, when you put them together, they taste sweet? Who's determined this? Second problem is, if everything is a question of law, why do we have so much confusion? Why are things so unpredictable? Where does we don't feel everything's working like clockwork from the time we're born to the time we die, and from the beginning of the day to the end of the day. There's so much that's unpredictable. There's so much we don't understand. So, and finally, whether it's chance or law, where does consciousness come from? If the universe started by chance, what are the chances that by throwing this deck of millions or billions of cards out on the floor somewhere, that someday the cards are going to start walking around, talking and thinking and writing books? This could not be chance. We don't find the law of human intelligence in the cars or in the stone or the mud or the plants. Where did this thing that we call consciousness come from? Well, a third hypothesis or a third explanation for this is the explanation, traditional explanation of religion, that the world is created by a conscious being. God. He's up there somewhere. He's somewhere outside of the cosmos, extra cosmos. He's looking down and creating this world and everything in it. Well, if God has created this world, then of course we can understand why we're conscious. Because God is an infinite, omnipotent consciousness, and therefore if he wants to make people in his image, he could have done a better job, but at least we know where we get consciousness from, because the divine is conscious. But if there was a God who created this world, why do we have ignorance at all? Why do we have falsehood? Why do we have scoundrels, Wickham? Why do we have people running around with their heads cut off like Lydia? Why do we have confusion? Why do we have sorrow? Why do we have pain? Why do we have death? Why do we have evil? This, no religion has been ever able to explain how or why an extra cosmic deity whose perfection itself, has all knowledge and all power, would like to create a mess like this. And Aurobindo says, if the explanation is that the world is the result of the thoughts of God, couldn't God have had better thoughts? He could have done a better job. So all these explanations fail. And he's told us his answer to this, and we discussed it briefly in the last month. He says, all of these questions get answered if you understand that indeed the world is created by a conscious being, an infinite, omniscient, omnipotent conscious being. But that being is not sitting up there looking on this and watching it like a puppet show for his amusement. That being has become the universe. That being has involved itself to become the universe, hidden itself, concealed itself in its apparent opposite, and is gradually, slowly, step by step, bit by bit, evolving out of that ignorance, out of that inconscience, in a play of self-discovery for the delight, for the extreme, intense delight of creating a world, of creating a universe, and manifesting itself, and having the joy of discovering itself. When we play a game, when the children love to play the game hide and seek, because they get to discover. But this is a game in which the divine gets to discover itself millions and billions of times over again. He gets to discover it in each of us. He gets to discover himself each day in each of us as we discover a little bit more of the reality. What is the reality? The truth of our being. The truth of the world, the truth of nature. Now maybe for some of us we feel this game is not as much fun as hide and seek. Hide and seek, we know it's only a game, but this one seems to be real to us. It's real to us because we are in the ignorance. But to the divine in us, to the divine in all of us, every moment in this game, every moment in this play, is an ecstatic experience of self-discovery. Darcy proposes to Lizzie, and she says, "You marry you? You're the last man on earth I would ever marry." For Darcy, I guess it wasn't a very amusing game at that moment. But for Jane Austen, in writing that story, she must have felt she's at the height of her creative power. And the joy and thrill she felt is like the joy that we feel when we hear how Lizzie abuses her, him and really gives him all that he deserves for his rude behavior. So Sri Aurobindo's hypothesis is, this world is the infinite that has cast itself into form, into infinite forms, infinite possibilities of itself, so that it can gradually evolve back and fully manifest the infinite powers, infinite capacities, infinite potentials that it has concealed within it. And he says that means behind every finite, this moment is a finite, this object is a finite, everything is a finite. We, living on the surface of our personalities, each of us is a finite ego. Every thought and emotion, feeling is a finite. Behind every one of these finites is the infinite. Behind every moment, there's an infinite creativity waiting to express itself the next moment. Behind every person, behind each of us, in each of our lives, there's an infinite potential, a spiritual being, our own being, even waiting and anxious for the adventure of consciousness where it can fully express itself so we can discover who we are. Every minute is an opportunity like this. Every situation is an opportunity. Every relationship is an opportunity. Just like it was for Darcy when Bingley came up to him at the dance and said, "Darcy, don't stand there being stupid. Dance. Why don't you dance with Miss Elizabeth Bennet? She's very nice. She's tolerable." There is the infinite, an infinite joy waiting for him at that moment. She's tolerable because he takes and mistakes the frontal appearance which he sees through his senses, he mistakes that for the reality. This creation is a disguise. What is it disguising? He tells us what it's disguising are truths and powers of the infinite. And his answer to what's determining everything is that truths and powers of the infinite are determining everything that happens at every moment. Where are those truths? Where are those powers? Is it really a truth and a power that's determining things today, now, here, in our lives? That's what we should understand. That's what we should begin to see if we really understand what he says in this chapter. The source of everything that's happening, everything in nature, is divine. But we have to learn how to discover that divine movement behind everything in our own lives. He says, this explanation solves the paradox and the mystery of the universe. If there's an infinite being behind everything, then we can certainly understand why there's so much variety in the world. Why we've got 7 billion people, each with a different fingerprint and a different personality, character, facial appearance. Why there are millions of species of life. Why every day is different. Every event is different. Variation is explained because what's trying to express itself is infinite. We can also understand, though, why there are some rules, why there's order, why there seems to be some laws, why there seems to be some logic and regularity to things, because working and expressing itself is not an infinite chaos. It's an infinite intelligence. It's an infinite consciousness that's carrying out in a very complex way, difficult for us to conceive, its own plan. There's a plan behind this. There's a purpose behind this. Everything that happens to us at every moment has a purpose behind it. We may not understand that purpose, but later on when we see, how did I get here? How did I ever come to mother? How did I ever have this fortune? How did Darcy come to Meryton? How did he meet Elizabeth? How did he end up married to her? When we look back at the end of the story, we see everything that's happened in the story, even with all the chaos and confusion, she hates him, she believes the lies about him, she abuses him and says he's the last man, then Lydia and Wickham elope, all these things that happen. It looks to be a chaos at the time. Certainly to Darcy it looked like a chaos, but when we see the end, yes, 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 everything that happens in the story is perfectly attuned. Not just that they should get married, that Darcy should discover a truth of himself and be capable of a love, which he was certainly never capable of, this proud, selfish, haughty man. And Lizzie should acquire a self-knowledge and a gratitude and be able to rise high. Everything that happened, happened for a purpose. While it was happening, it looks like a chaos. But ultimately, we see there was an intention behind it. So we can understand, and when we look at the world, so much of intention. Why does rain come? And why are there minerals in the soil? And why does this soil grow wonderful fruits and grains that we can eat? And why does the bee help the flower pollinate and then collect honey that we can collect and have something sweet? Why is it that so many plants, thousands and thousands of plants, have magical healing properties? Why shouldn't all the plants be poisonous? Why is it that so many, every ailment we have, there's a cure and there's a plan for it? Why is she that way? There is so much of intention here because he tells us there's a supreme consciousness behind that's running the show. And that consciousness is gradually emerging out of the opposite. It's buried itself in the inconscience, and it's coming out. Why it has done that, what joy it gets out of that, well, he talked about it in two chapters on the delight of existence, and he's going to talk about it again. But this is the knowledge that he wants us to have. The divine, which is infinite, has concealed itself in matter, in the inconscient, in the ignorance, and is working out a divine manifestation. And he says that if you really understand this, you discover that all the unexplained processes of nature can be explained by this hypothesis. And he's going to talk to us for many chapters about why we have ignorance, why we have suffering, why we have pain, why even we have something called evil. And he's going to also show us very clearly, not just philosophically, that evil plays a crucial role in the spiritual evolution. It's not an accident. It's not a mistake. It's not an aberration. Just the way we see that Wickham's evil words, false evil words about Darcy play an essential role in Darcy's awakening, in Darcy becoming a better person. He said, this knowledge will explain why out of a small, tiny, simple seed, we get this magnificent thing called a tree, with flowers on it, with leaves on it, with fruits on it. How can this tiny little thing create that? Because buried within that seed, behind it, not physically in it, behind it in the subtle, is something called the real idea. The spiritual idea, the concept, the design, the instruction for the seed to become a tree. And behind each of us, there is an idea, a spiritual power, the essence of our soul, of our spiritual individuality, which is guiding our development just like the seed creates the growth of the tree, except our development goes over many lifetimes. This is a long show. We go through so many plantings and sproutings to be fully developed. We don't see what being developed in us is an infinite spiritual potential and manifestation. He says this explains why the body can influence our mind. Because we think the body is unconscious or has no consciousness. But the body also has a consciousness. And it influences our mental conscious processes. It also explains how the mind can influence the body. How Morris Goodman can say, within 12 months, I'm going to walk out of here. Every bone in my body is broken. And the doctor says, I'd be dead in a week. I'm going to walk out of here in 12 months. Of course, it wasn't his mind that said that. It was his soul. But how can something immaterial affect the body? Because both are forms of consciousness. Well, he's going to come back and explain all of this in much more detail in the subsequent chapters. But this is his essential answer. Now, I thought it would be helpful. The real message for me of this chapter is, he's not talking philosophy. He's talking practicality. What does this have to do with us? It's okay we the Spirit, it's very nice to know that. It's nice to know after thousands of births, I'm going to end up being something I'd be happy about. It's nice to know that there's a Satchitananda up there and all. But what does it have to do with us where we are today? If we really understand this chapter, we will understand it has a practical message for us every day in every moment. I thought it would be useful to give an example. It happens to be an example that Appa has been, we have been discussing it for the last couple of months, and really a very fascinating experience about it, and great insights into this truth in the real world. It's an example about the American Civil War, which probably many of you don't know much about it, and all that's essential I will tell you in a few minutes to illustrate this point. 151 years ago, a war was waged in the United States to determine whether the country as we know it today would exist or whether it would break up into pieces. And this map shows you what the U.S. looked like in 1861. The pink states on the, mostly on the top and a few at the end, are states where slavery was banned. The green states are states where slavery was practiced. And the other states were really not yet part of the country. But there was the idea that eventually the United States, we started as 13 colonies on the East Coast. The idea was it's the destiny of this country to spread and become one single entity. And already by this time, California and Oregon had become parts of the country. Texas was just taken over from Mexico about 10 years earlier. And it was only a question of time. Now, this area is about three times the size of India. It's bigger than Western Europe. The 28 countries of Western Europe can fit inside this. So one country, in place of all the countries of Western Europe, which have dominated history for the last 500 years, it's something new. It was something new at that time. It was in the stage of being created. But there was a problem. The problem was slavery. When we look back now on slavery, it sounds so barbaric that we can never imagine that there was a time when it was very prevalent in the world. Of course, we still had something almost equivalent to slavery here called indentured servitude, where somebody owes money and is forced to work. Theoretically, it's been abolished at independence, but in practice, if you go to the really backward areas, you'll still find that it exists in practice. But 200 years ago, slavery was practiced all over by the Western world. The Dutch, the Portuguese, the English, the French, they collected slaves, sold them, particularly for plantations in the New World, where there weren't enough people to develop it. So it's got an old history in Europe. The European countries became a little civilized very late, and they decided this slavery is not a good thing. And one after another, they banned the slavery. They said, no more slaves here, and no more trading in the slaves. But the problem was, you had 11 states here that were all having 4 million slaves. And Europe was very dependent on these slaves because America was the chief source of cotton in the world at that time. And the Industrial Revolution depended on cotton for its production. It was the main product. And all this cotton coming to Europe at that time was coming from North America, from the southern states, which was grown by slaves. So the Europeans said no more slaves. It's evil. It's very bad and everything. But we still want cotton, even if it's grown by slaves. Now what happened? The U.S. attacked and took over Mexico, Texas as its latest state. And the question arose, should we allow slaves there? The northern state said no slavery. If as we expand into the new territories of the gold and yellow color there, no more slavery. All the northern states had banned it. The southern states said wherever there's a new territory, we want to have slaves there. And they quarreled over this, and finally these green states decided, and states plus decided, we are going to separate and create a different. We're going to create our own country. They called it the Confederate States of America instead of the United States of America. They formed their own government, actually very close to Washington, D.C. in Virginia, Richmond, Virginia, not more than maybe 100, 200 miles away. They formed their own government, and they said, we are creating a new country. And the Civil War was fought over the issue of whether these 11 states have a right to separate out and become a different country. And the results of that war were so important for the world that if the outcome had been different than it is, at least today, there would not be a superpower called the United States. The chances are, if the outcome of the war had been different, that today California would be a country, and it would have about the 13th largest economy in the world, even as a separate country. Texas would probably be a country of its own. North America would look more like Europe. There would have been 10 or 15 or 20 different countries, and now they'd be struggling after 150 years to see if they can get together and form a union. But that didn't happen because of the outcome of the war. 5 years they fought this war. It was the bloodiest war in the history of humanity up until that time because of the Industrial Revolution. They had learned how to make big weapons, make steel ships. So it was the first modern war in which hundreds of thousands of people died. And the question is, why did the war turn out as it did? What really determined the outcome of the war? And there have been thousands of books, literally thousands of books written to explain why the northern states won the war and continued to keep the country as one country, and very soon it spread and took over all of North America. But these explanations are very questionable. One answer is that the stronger party won. The northern population was twice as big as the southern population, so they outnumbered the south. The northern population had all the industry. All the south had was cotton. You can't fight a war with cotton. But you can export cotton and buy anything with it, including all the weapons and ships and guns that you need. If it was a question of economic power or physical power, it won't explain why, during the first year and a half of this war, the South was defeating the North on every battle. All of the great generals of the United States belonged to the South, fought on the side of the South. The entire Northern Army consisted of only 16,000 troops. 16,000 troops at the time that the war began. By the end of the war, they had 700,000. They were not prepared for war. They were not producing weapons. They didn't have military leaders. Apart from that, the European countries that said, no, slavery is very bad, they also said, if you eliminate slavery, we won't get cotton. If we don't get cotton, we won't have jobs for our people. We won't have economic growth and prosperity. So Europe, England, France, other countries were very, very, very close to supporting the Confederacy, the South, in this war. Because it looked like after the first year and a half that the South would be able to continue, would be able to be fight for itself and defend itself. And it came within a hair's breadth of Europe saying, we support the South and we will give you the weapons you need, which they were doing anyway. And the country would have been split up. There would be no America, and many of you may not have offspring living in North America today. It wouldn't be a place to go to. So there's no simple explanation for why the war was won. In fact, the more you look into it, the more doubtful it is. The head of the Northern armies was a General McClellan, who was from the South. He was one who actually believed slavery was okay. But he was a most talented general, and every time the president tried to tell him to attack the Southerners, he made an excuse that, no, I don't have enough troops. There was a time when he had 80,000, 120,000 troops. He said, the enemy has 140,000. I don't have enough to attack. Actually, the enemy had only 40,000 on the opposite camp. Why he did this? Because he figures if the next election comes in 2 years, everybody was telling it popular, you'll be the next president. You want to be the president of the entire country, not of a northern split. If you attack and defeat the Southerners, they'll never vote for you. So it's better you postpone, you delay, you procrastinate long enough till the next election, then you get elected president and you make peace with the South and let them keep their slavery. That was his plan. And he's the key man that the North is depending on to win the war. He refuses to fight. So it was at all obvious who would win this war. Then there's the question of chance. At a crucial battle, the crucial battle where McClellan is on one side of the river and General Robert E. Lee, the most famous American general at that time, was leading the South on the other side. And McClellan is saying, I can't attack because of too many troops. Some officer of his army was walking in the fields and he saw a small paper bundle on the ground and he picked it up and he opened it and he saw, to his great surprise and delight, there were three cigars in the bundle. Three expensive Cuban cigars. Oh, this is very nice. What a lucky day for me. We're not fighting, so I can relax. And I get these three cigars. I'm a very lucky man. This very expensive thing. And for a soldier, smoking is a great delight. Then when he was looking at these cigars, he looked at the paper in which they were wrapped. This crumpled sheet of paper. And he saw a signature on it. And he said, this signature I know. The man who has signed this paper is an officer in the Southern Army. And he began with curiosity to read the paper. And according to this paper, there were only 40,000 men in Lee's army, not 140,000 like the general believed. Oh, then we should attack. That means we're wrong. We've had the wrong intelligence. He quickly ran to his officer, and then they took it to the general and showed him the paper. We attacked today. And that was a turning point in the war because he found three cigars in the piece of paper. If there hadn't been the cigars, he wouldn't have looked at the paper. He was more interested in the cigars. So it looks like chance. It looks like that original theory is right. After all, such a crucial event comes by such a small, it really looks like, yes, chance is there. It's not divine. It's not this, it's that. It's chance. was the determinant? Well, some people say the real determinant was a man named Abraham Lincoln, a man who is, by some estimates, the most famous president, maybe the most famous American of all times. Because it was President Lincoln, who was the president at that time, who succeeded not only in winning the war and keeping the country united, but also succeeded in abolishing slavery, which looked to be impossible just a few years before. He did both. Well, when you look at this and say, this huge country that's the most powerful and most prosperous country in the world is the result of one man's effort. Is it possible? If this man had not been president at the time, there's a very good chance that the U.S. would not exist today as we know it. That anybody else who was in his position may not have been able, probably could not have done what he did. If he won the war, maybe slavery would have been there for another 50, 75 years. He was able to win the war and abolish the slavery. This is a man who grew up in a wilderness area without any education. He educated himself. He lived in a log cabin where they wore animal skins. They didn't even have shoes. They didn't have cotton or wool clothes. They literally in utter poverty. He educated himself. And he grew up, went on to become a postmaster. He did all types of jobs, finally became a lawyer, and eventually became a member of Congress, and eventually was elected as president. And when you read his story, which is the book that Appa's been reading, you're struck by the fact this man had such a wisdom, a remarkable wisdom, and he had such a humility. One of the unusual things he did was, when he became president, he took all enemies and he made them members of his cabinet. The normal philosophy is, when you want people who will cooperate with you to be around you and follow your instructions. He said, it's good to have friends close by. It's more important to keep your enemies where you can see them. Sri Aurobindo starts Life Divine that say, contradictions are compliments. He created a cabinet of all those who opposed him and managed through that to reunite the country and made all of those people work together and balance out their conflicting needs and all their schemes, and how many of them wanted to be president and replace him, by working with them and seeing there's something more important than each of us. Another amazing thing he did, he had a tremendous sense of humility. He never thought of himself. He never thought, what will make me important, like Mrs. Bennett? What will give me more power? He always thought, how can I achieve my goals? I don't matter. What matters is the country must be united. The slavery must be abolished. He believed there was a determinant. He believed that God was the determinant. And he prayed to God intensely, please help me, guide me. When can I free the slaves? What should I do? And when the three cigars were found, and the paper, and the first significant victory by the North over the South after 2 years of warfare, he said, this is a sign. And so he immediately announced that slavery is abolished at a time when all the people, even in the North, even in his cabinet, said, don't do it now, because we'll lose the little support we have from some of the border states. You better wait later. Don't do it. No, I'm doing it now. God has given me a sign. And he did it, and he issued the proclamation abolishing slavery. And the minute the war was over, that became a constitutional amendment. So what does all this have to do with cosmic determinants? Was it the chance of the three cigars? Was it the military power or economic power of the North? Was it the power of one inspired, self-sacrificing, idealistic individual with a great deal of wisdom? Was it chance? What was it that really determined? Well, if you push aside all of the details, what you see is there really was something that determined the outcome. It wasn't a question of chance. It wasn't a question of economic power. The real thing that determined it were two things: freedom and unity. The people who had come to the U.S. as immigrants, and almost all of them impoverished people from other countries, the European countries at that time, they came looking for one thing: freedom and equality. Freedom to speak what they thought, which they couldn't do at home. Freedom to worship any religion they wanted, which they couldn't do back in Europe. Freedom to not worry about what my class is or caste is, or where I fit in the house, or who I can talk to because they have a title or something like Lady Catherine. All of that, they said, no. We want the freedom to discover who we are and express our capacities. America was founded on that. Yet the Southerners said that freedom is only for the white man. Freedom's very important, but only for us, not for them. If the South had won the war, we might still have people arguing today that freedom is only for some people, that only some people are created equal and other people are created unequal. The decision of Gandhiji to abolish unequality here 50 years ago was inspired by the fact that finally, in the last huge place in the world, slavery had been declared illegal, unacceptable, a total abomination, and falsehood. That was the deepest value. The other value that he fought for was unity. We may be all different. We may come with different religions, different nationalities, different languages, different backgrounds, different beliefs, so forth. But fundamentally, we are all human beings. And we must be able to live in harmony and unity with one another. And the U.S. has become the country in the world that embodies, it's all nations are there. You land in the airport, in any of the international airports, you look around and you wonder which country are you in. If you go to San Francisco, you'll see even in the hotel, in the airport itself, you'll see there's Chinese food, Japanese food, all types of food. Which country did we land in? We don't know. And everybody looks like they're from everybody place because they are. So what happened in America because unity was preserved, now they're trying to work out in Europe by the European Union 150 years later. India, Sri Aurobindo says that this is the greatest experiment of nature with a very complex mix of different religions, different ethnic groups, different languages, so many different languages. Nature is trying to show unity. Just everything has to evolve to a unity. So our conclusion is that the real determinant, the real cosmic determinant for the end of the, for the outcome of the Civil War was freedom and unity. What is freedom? What is unity? Freedom and unity are the aspects of the spirit. They're fundamental aspects of the spirit. The characteristic of the spirit differentiates it from everything else we know is it's totally free. It can be anything, but it's never limited by anything it becomes. Freedom is, Sri Aurobindo says, the last law, the final consummation. Freedom is the highest spiritual quality. And what is the truth of freedom? Unity. That we are all one. That the underlying truth of everything is a spiritual oneness. So here's a nasty war being fought for political reasons, economic reasons, for social reasons, for all things. But behind it, what is really determining the outcome? The highest spiritual determinants that are trying to realize themselves in this, that country at that time, as a model for what the whole world should be in future. We should be free and equal, and we should be united. And we're a long way from that. Even in India, even in the U.S. today, there's no equality. We may have freedom, but we certainly don't have equality. And unity is only a very, very thin thread, like in India, where there's so many conflicts. But this is what's trying to express itself in the world. This is why Sri Aurobindo fought World War II in Europe. Because he said, what's at stake here is not just a war or colonies or anything. It is the values of freedom for all and unity for humanity. That was what's at stake. So behind all of this, there was something that was driving that outcome. Just as we see in Pride and Prejudice, behind everything that we see in the story, behind all the characters and their actions, there was something driving the outcome. That is, as Appa has said, the country was trying to avoid a French Revolution. It was trying to avoid being torn apart. England was trying to avoid the violence and massacre of the aristocracy that occurred in France by a peaceful unification based on freedom. Same idea. The very same idea was behind the outcome of Pride and Prejudice. The classes must come together in greater freedom and equality for greater unity of the country, because this division tears the country apart. You cannot have progress without greater unity. So even in this story, we have seen Darcy marrying Elizabeth, Bingley marrying Jane, Lydia Wickham becoming a brother-in-law of Darcy. All of this was unifying a highly stratified society. So this is the central message of the chapter. But unity and freedom are only two of the fundamental aspects of the spirit. There are many others. Can we discover in our own lives fundamental aspects and attributes of the spirit that are trying to evolve and express themselves, that are determining what's happening in our lives? I look at it like a river. The river of life in North America was flowing, and it's still flowing, towards total freedom, equality, and unity. The South decided to swim in the other direction. We don't want freedom for the blacks. We want freedom only for ourselves. We don't want unity with the rest. We want to be separate. They were washed away in the flood of the evolution. In PNP, Lady Catherine said, none of this freedom and equality business. I have not become a very important person in order to allow everybody to treat me like an equal. Darcy at the beginning of the story is, I don't want people like this Collins coming up and introducing themselves. I'm an important man. I'm not going to dance with that tolerable Miss Bennett just because they're Savage is dancing here. He wants to go in the other direction. He's swimming upstream. He's swimming against the current. What happened? He got washed away by the tsunami and ended up married to Elizabeth, who he had called tolerable. Even Lady Catherine, with all her power and money and self-importance, could not resist the inevitable movement. Even Caroline, with all her meanness and jealousy and envy and poison, ended up saying, saying, I will go along also. Because whether you fight it or you do it, it's going to happen. It's inevitable. What it means for us is, if we decide, instead of swimming against the current, like we see so many, like Wickham was doing, Lady Catherine was doing, even Mrs. Bennet was doing, she wanted the current only so she could dominate over Lady Lucas and be proud and dominate over her husband. We see everybody who tried to swim against the current either got washed out or washed downstream. The current is irresistible. What does it mean for us? It means if we know the direction of the current, doesn't it make sense to swim in that direction? Doesn't it make sense to be carried by the current upwards from wherever we are to Pemberley, from Longbourn to Pemberley, from wherever we are to a higher level? Doesn't that make more sense than fighting it and going in the other direction? These cosmic determinants, which are spiritual determinants, are inevitable. They can never be defeated. We can have the joy of opposition if we want it. We can go down fighting the South with hundreds of thousands of people, and they set back their progress by decades because they decided to fight and go in the wrong direction. But they didn't stop the abolition of slavery. They didn't stop the forward progress of humanity. That's why India's unity, India's progress is so essential for the world. The end. Winston Churchill said, I will not preside over the dissolution of Majesty's empire. What happened? Winston Churchill was dissolved. You cannot stand in the way of destiny. That's why in chapter 1, Sri Aurobindo says that the supramental manifestation, the divine life, is inevitable. The divine life is inevitable. That's the direction of the evolution. Spiritual determinants are working themselves out. If we know what those determinants are, if we know what they're trying to do, and we say, well, then let me grab onto them and be towed into the future or fly into the future rather than hold on to everything that I have to give up. And in this chapter, he tells us what they are. What are those determinants that we should be clinging to so that we get carried forward instead of always struggling and ending up in trouble like Mrs. Bennet and spoiling everything that just as it's beginning to develop? Well, he says, in order to know what real determinants are, we have to make a progress, because our minds are not capable of knowing what those determinants are. If we say, how come, if it's so obvious that freedom and equality and unity are so important, I don't see all of that. What is it? He said, our problem is that we try to understand the world through mind. And mind is an instrument of ignorance. And mind is an instrument of division. I came across an interesting fact a little while. You know, he keeps telling us the problem is you cannot believe what the senses tell you. The senses, our minds base themselves on the senses. The senses distort reality. I recently read a book by a scientist. He asked the question, what is the sound of a fallen tree? A tree, when a big tree falls in the forest, what does it sound like? Somebody says it makes a loud boom. He says, no. When a huge tree falls in the forest, it doesn't make any noise at all. It doesn't make any noise at all. Not a sound. Then what happens? What it does do is, when a huge tree falls in the forest, as it hits the ground, it sends compression of air waves, very highly compressed air waves over long distances, just like if you threw a huge boulder into the lake, it will create waves over a long period of time. But it doesn't make sound. But if you're in the forest at that time when the tree falls, you will hear a loud sound. Then the loud sound is in your mind. The loud sound is what your mind interprets. All that you actually get is airwaves. It's your ear that converts the waves of compression into a loud sound ringing in your head. It's not there. And if there's nobody in the forest, there'll be no sound to be heard. It's the way the mind interprets that event. So our minds are like that. We take the sense reality, we think it's everything. We see the sun moving as we're sitting here from one side to the other. And I'm standing still, sun is moving. We take that for reality. This mind can never know the cosmic determinants because it looks at things superficially from outside. Not only that, but our minds are lost in themselves. I think we all have that experience. We sit quiet for a little while. We're supposed to be meditating, and after 15 minutes, we thought, oh, I was thinking about what was for dinner tomorrow or where we're going, or I forgot to pack my suitcase correctly, or I wonder why that person hasn't called me, or what's... We're lost. It's not like we're sitting here calmly looking at the universe and knowing the reality. We're really lost in the mind. And what is the mind? It's mental energy. It's like the ocean with all the waves going up. We're lost in the waves on the surface, going from one thing to another. And we do it all day long and even in the night. Mind continues. This is not an instrument that can find out what's really governing the universe. If we really want to know what's governing the universe, we're going to have to get out of this instrument to something that's more reliable. It's more complicated than that because he says, if we really succeed in quieting our mind, we find out that most of our thoughts don't come from our head at all. They come from outside. We are so lost in our thoughts, anything happens to be in my head, I think it's mine. I don't know that somebody else is thinking that thought, and therefore it comes into my head. Everything that comes into my head, I think, is my thought. It belongs to me. I'm very selfish and possessive because anything that goes in the head, I claim it as my own. But it's not like that. Thoughts come up from our body. Thoughts come down from the higher planes. All of this is like a railway station with people going all directions. It cannot know the reality. So if we want to know really what the determinants are at every minute, the first thing we have to do is we have to get out of the limitations of the mind. And we can do this by yogic practices. The first yogic practice is to silence the mind, to quiet the mind. When we try to quiet the mind, when we say, okay, stop thinking, stop talking, just calm down and let me really see what's going on. When we really try to do that, the first thing we see is the mind is not in our control. The energy is just going. The thoughts are going. Even if we manage for a few minutes, oh, yes, this is nice. It's quiet. Stop thinking. It's nice. I can't stop thinking about it. We can't stop the movement, but gradually we withdraw more and more. And we see the mind is like the surface of an ocean. And the waves come, the wind comes, and it just keeps moving. And if we require to be very, very, very quiet, come to realize there's something behind the surface that's watching. Instead of being a wave on the surface, we can go deep, deep down and see there's something looking up and seeing those waves on the surface. It's the mental being, the mental purusha. And then we become self-aware that the mind itself is part of the cosmic movement. It can't tell us what the determinant is because itself, it is determined by the movement. It's part of the problem. It's not part of the solution. You can't ask the criminal to tell you who robbed the bank. He's the guilty party. The mind is part of the problem because it's part of the nature of the universal movement. It's not the determinant of that movement. So we try to go back spiritually through yoga and identify with the mental purusha, the witness. And if we succeed in doing that, we see this witness has the power to stop the movement. When a thought comes in, no. When it says, I'm angry, no. Whatever movement comes on the surface, if we detach from it, we have that has the capacity to say, no, I don't sanction that. I don't accept that. I'm other than my mind. I'm other than my thoughts. I'm just like Lizzie, who was so angry when she read the letter at Huntsford. Oh, Darcy has done this, Darcy's done that. She was so angry with him. Gradually, she stood back and said, I think the problem is not Darcy. I think the problem is me. I think I've been acting like a fool. I never knew myself till now. She began to see herself as a second person and see the ignorance in which she was. How can she know the determinants when she's herself buried in the ignorance? She has to get out of the ignorance first. So the detaching of the mind from the movement of the mind is one step towards knowledge. The problem is when we do that, we find out the mind is not just our individual mind. There's a universal mind in which these movements are taking place. And as long as we are in the individual mind, we are caught in the universal movement. We cannot know reality. So we have to go further. We have to discover that behind the universal mind, there is a self which is transcendent of the universe. And only when we are there, we can see the whole universal movement as if it's the waves on the shore. It's that universal movement that's being determined by something. What is determining that movement? Why is the earthquake happening now? Why is the war coming now? Why is it raining today? Why is India prospering now, or why is the rupee going down? We have to go and see what's behind that's determining everything. He says, mind cannot do this. Even if we reach the mental being or purusha, we cannot do this. So the yogi tries, he says, rise to overmind. Overmind is a status, we discussed it a few months ago. Overmind is the first faculty in us which is capable of really seeing the truth of the cosmos, And what's determining things? It can see that there's something coming from the transcendent and acting in the universe. The only problem is, the overmind loves everybody. It accepts everything as it is. You remember when Krishna revealed his vision to Arjuna, and he showed him the cosmic creation, the great creation, the great destruction. Arjuna almost fainted and wanted to run away from this thing. What did he understand from that? He did not get the knowledge, except that Krishna said, I am doing all of this, I've come to destroy all of these people. Why? He got the vision. He had that great overmental vision of reality. But it didn't answer any question. And when we read it, we don't get the answer. Because overmind accepts everything. It sees the truth in everything. But it doesn't see the essential truth that's trying to express itself. If we want to know what is really determining the world, overmind doesn't give us the answer. Overmental experience, we can see the divine qualities in everything expressing in the universe. What we call the saguna, what they call the saguna Brahman. We can see everything has the divine behind it. But we equally have the experience, the divine is not this, the divine is not that, the divine is a peace and a silence behind. It's something totally different. Well, is this divine a divine being that's creating everything, or is the divine a silent self that's aloof and detached from everything? The answer the overmind says is yes. Yes means, is it a yes or a no? Yes. It's both a yes and a no. It's this and it's that. It's this and it's that, which is its opposite. Would you make up your mind and tell me, is this chance or is it necessity? Is this a divine will or is it not the divine will? Yes, it's everything. Overmind sees all the truths, but it doesn't know how to reconcile them. What does this have to do with that? I have experience of the silent self. I have experience of the divine being, but they seem to be opposite experiences, unrelated to one another. Overmind says they're both true. But what are they doing? Why are they the way they are? How do they relate to each other? Overmind doesn't give us the answer. So we have to go further. We have to go to supermind. Now, when we get to supermind, we come to the point where we can see the solution. First time. We can make sense out of the cosmos and everything that happens in it, and everything that happens in our own lives and the lives of other people around us. Mother used to say, she describes an agenda that after having a supermental experience and she came back into the normal consciousness, everything seems so laughable, so funny, because the way it looks on the surface is so different than actually what's going on. It was because the way we see things is so different than the reality. You just imagine in this story when Darcy is introduced to Elizzie. If Darcy's to really know the truth, how different his position must be. Darcy thinks he's proud, he's important, he's better than everybody else. She's a tolerable girl. Bingley's a fool who he's just kind of, as a friend, he's carrying him along and helping him grow up. Carolyn, anything great, but at least she's praising and flattering him all the time. It's nice to have somebody who recognizes your greatness all the time. But what is the real truth in that situation? If Darcy's to really awaken to the truth, what does he have to realize? He has to acquire the consciousness of Jane Austen. He said, what would Jane Austen tell him? Darcy, don't be a fool. This is a love story I'm reading. I'm trying to create a character that will be famous for 200 years. And some movie star who plays your part 200 years from now will get the Academy Award and become world famous, and they'll build statues to him. Don't you know this is a story about love and fulfillment, social evolution? Darcy's not thinking of love when he comes to Meryton. He's certainly not thinking of the evolution of the society. He's not thinking of anything except his own self-importance. For us to really know what's going on in our lives, really understand our lives properly, the change in our perspective has to be as much as the change from Darcy to Jane Austen. We have to become identified with the author, not identify with the part. When Wickham scandalizes and tells lies about him, or when somebody tells lies about us, or things that are equally bad, we have to know what's the cosmic determinant here. Why is this happening? How does this fit in my spiritual romance, in my spiritual destiny and fulfillment? How is this moving me along the river of progress? How can I swim with the current to find the divine delight rather than quarreling with Wickham or competing with Lady Lucas or crying or anything else? How do I change my perspective? In order to have that knowledge, we have to go to Supermind. Supermind knows that this is in Austin's story and everything is true. It's a true creation of Jane Austen's story of how the society is growing and people are evolving. And what we find when we get to Supermind is that the reality is there's a conscious power that is determining everything. That conscious power is aware of itself as infinite and eternal. That's Satchitananda. But it's also aware that it's infinite power to become anything it wants to be. And that's what has become the universe. The reality is not some far off, distant, vacant emptiness. It's not a quiet library somewhere where Mr. Bennett can take refuge from all the confusion of the world. It is an infinite power that knows itself as infinite and eternal, but also knows it has infinite power to become anything it wants to become, and it has chosen to become this universe, to become this planet, and to become all of us for the joy of an evolutionary progression. There can be no question of saying life is an illusion. The power that's created life is Satchitananda. There can be no question of saying this is by chance or this is a mistake. Nothing is by mistake. Even the conscious lies of Wickham are not by mistake. Everything is exactly as it should be and needs to be for our progress. This this creation, is a self-manifestation, a progressive self-manifestation that starts with the stone and the mud and is going to reveal itself as divine. And each of us is the key star, a key star in this story. Each of us has a divinity that needs to come out to manifest, and we have the joy of discovering what that is. We have the joy of discovering that what's trying to come out is infinite, infinite in power, infinite in consciousness, eternal in existence, and infinite in delight. And that everything that happens to us in our lives and everything that exists is a partial expression of truth trying to emerge. So our job at every moment is not to say, I don't like this, I don't want this, I want something else. What is the truth in this? Why does Wickham come and spread lies about me? Why does Bingley come and ask me to dance with that tolerable girl? If we're Lizzie, why is the mother trying to make me marry Collins, that buffoon? Why, when everything's just going perfectly, does Lydia elope and spoil and destroy everything? Instead of saying, I like this, I don't like this, this was good, that was bad, what is the truth that's trying to express? And we see each of these characters in the story has discovered a little bit more of the truth that's trying to express in their lives. And every time they do that, every time they get a little, oh, this is what's trying to come. Yes, yes, I accept. I go in that direction. Their life flowers. And that's the knowledge he's offering to us. At every moment, there's a truth presenting itself to us. And if we turn in the right direction, we can rise as dramatically as she did by becoming Mistress of Pemberley. What are these truths that Supermind knows? What are these truths? Where do they come from? How do we understand them? He gives us the essential formula in this chapter. He says the real determinant of everything is the highest known expression of the Absolute, which tradition calls Satchitananda. An infinite existence, an infinite conscious force, and an infinite delight. Everything that exists in the world comes from these three, which is one. In Overmind, it looks, or in Mind, it looks like there are three. There's only one. This is the reality that's expressing itself. Can we discover Satchitananda in the world, in our lives? How does this one that is three explain the whole world? He says there's a process. And he walks us through the first stages of that process in this chapter. He says each of these three manifests powers and potentialities of itself. And we all know, we read it before, discussed it before, delight, the Ananda of Satchitananda, puts forth aspects of itself, three aspects of itself, which are the fundamental spiritual determinants of Ananda in the universe: beauty, love, and joy. Beauty, love, and joy are the powers of Ananda expressing themselves in the universe. And if you think about the story, how important beauty, love, and joy are to this story. Jane is that epitome of physical beauty. She's trying to have beauty in her thoughts, trying to be beautiful in her goodness. Her goodness is psychological beauty. I want to be good, she says. Love is what moves Darcy. He feels an emptiness. He feels cut off because he separated himself from everybody. Naturally, he'll be lonely. Love is that calling him to come out of his loneliness, come out of his separateness, and find the delight right belonging with somebody else, and that's the problem of the aristocracy. They've locked themselves up in the library. They're trying to be separate from everybody, and therefore they're dying. Lady Anne is so ill. Lady Catherine doesn't have hundreds of people anxious to meet with her. She has to pay Collins to come every day and have tea with him, because nobody wants to visit this beautiful palace. Who wants to go and sit and listen to this old lady talking nonsense all the time? So they cut themselves off. And this is a story of that love, his love, closing the gap, bringing the aristocracy back into the fold of society, the same way India is trying to bring the castes which have been divided back to create a unified, recognizing we're all human beings. And the world is trying to recognize that it doesn't matter what country we are, what religion we are, what race we are, what's the color of our skin or the language we speak, we're all fundamentally human beings. Our strength comes from our unity, not from asserting our superiority to one another. That's what's acting out. And joy? Elizabeth is the embodiment of joy. She has the native cheerfulness and mirth, which is itself a high spiritual quality. It's that that attracts Darcy to her. Whatever her mother is, whatever her dowry is or not, this girl has something special about her that he needs. What is it? She's so full of cheer. He's a dull, he may have all the money and all the self-importance, but the life is empty for him. His heart is empty. There's no meaning in his life. This girl has it. She has nothing, but she's so happy. And when he's with her, he feels alive. Even when she's in, he feels thrilled. I feel alive when even I don't ever know what she's going to say the next minute. She's a mystery. But I feel the joy when I look at her, and I see her courage and her strength and her energy and her individuality. So these three supramental spiritual aspects are the keys to the story, but they're not the whole key. Satchitananda is also an infinite conscious force. And he says, this infinite conscious force puts forth, expresses itself in the universe as the cosmic determinants of knowledge and will. And if you look at the history of humanity over thousands of years, the one thing we can say without any doubt, with all the wars and all the confusion and everything, is man, human beings are seeking knowledge. There is a quest for knowledge from the beginning. Thousands of years ago, civilization, we've always been seeking knowledge to understand more, understand ourselves, understand the world, understand the ultimate reality more. And to have the power or the will to apply that knowledge for results. Right now, India wants to be prosperous. What is the knowledge? Where do we get the knowledge? Everybody's craving the education because we'll get a good job and we can have a successful career and we can become prosperous. Knowledge and put into action. So the whole history of humanity is a quest for knowledge and the application of that knowledge creatively to build a human society, which we have been doing for thousands of years and now is happening so quickly. In the story, Darcy acquires a knowledge he never knew existed, a knowledge that he wasn't looking for. But when Lizzie says, "You think that I have refused you just because you spoke a little rudely? From the first month in which I knew you, I decided you're the last man on earth I would ever marry. You're so selfish, you're so proud, you're so arrogant, you're mean. Who would ever want to marry you?" He tells her at the end of the story, "You gave me a very tough lesson, but I'm better for it. I got a knowledge. I'm a happier, better man today because of that knowledge. Because of that knowledge, I had the will. I decided I will go and save the day. I will go and find Wickham. I will take responsibility, consciousness responsibility. Find Wickham, save, get Bingley married. I made a mistake, I will change it. I made a mistake of not warning about Wickham, telling the world, I will correct it. I will pay out of my own money. I'll have the sincerity to do the work, to pay the price out of my own, because he knew in the depths that if he does that, he'll also find the joy and the love that he was longing for. These are cosmic determinants. It's not just a romance written by a silly 19-year-old girl 200 years ago. She's expressing eternal truths. Lizzie had that knowledge. One of the highlights of the whole story and the most admirable thing about Lizzie is when she reads his letter at Hunsford, that she has the sincerity to say, yes, as I was blaming him for everything, but the truth is, we are to blame. It's not Darcy that spoiled Jane's chances. It's my whole family. My mother ruined it. My father ruined it. Lydia ruined it. I myself have not behaved properly. I have been absurd. She had the sincerity to acquire knowledge. We all know that when knowledge presents itself, it's not always a sweet candy. It very often comes as a bitter pill. But it's a bitter pill that when we swallow it with courage and take the lesson, life always becomes sweeter later on. It's a bitter pill that cures and helps enlighten us and liberate us so that we're capable of greater joy and greater power and greater effectiveness of will. This knowledge is the most important thing that we can get for our progress. And every day, life is presenting us with endless opportunities for that knowledge. Each time we see somebody do something that was really stupid, that was really unpardonable, that was really selfish, we think we're getting a knowledge about another person. Yes, that person's very stupid and that person's very selfish. Life is offering us free of charge, no admission charge, no tuition, not lakhs and lakhs to get into. See, the ultimate wisdom is being offered to us at every minute. We should be grateful to everybody rather than feeling superior. Because everybody is offering us what we most need to move with the current, to move from Longbourn to Pemberley. Mostly we look and turn in the other direction. No. I'm superior to all of that. That is what we need, that knowledge. Mr. Bennett, when he's confronted with the disaster, the catastrophe that he has brought down on himself and the family by sending her to Brighton, he looks back with sincerity and says, Lizzie, you told me. You had the wisdom. You told me not to send her. I was a fool. I was lazy. I wanted the satisfaction of being peace and quiet for a few months. Now for the rest of my life, I have to pay the price for 1 month's peace and quiet. He had the knowledge. He acquired the knowledge. He saw what he learned from it. And he had the sincerity of will. Well, why should Mr. Gardner pay for my mistake? He may be willing, but I'm not willing to accept it. If I'm going to benefit from this knowledge, I have to accept the responsibility and pay the price. I must pay for Lydia's marriage, not expect him to do it. Even if I have to starve for the next 10 years or deny my family, it's my responsibility. And the moment he took that responsibility, the debt was paid, three daughters were married. Because what was necessary is not that he starved for 10 years. What was necessary was he acquired the true attitude. It's possible he could have taken 10 years to acquire it. He did it in a moment. He made the progress 10 years in 1 minute by accepting the knowledge and accepting the will. And that's, if it took Darcy a year to figure it all out. The story could have been over in a couple of weeks instead of a year. We may not have, it may not be such a famous novel then. But we see what we do. We take a year to do what can be done in a week. We take 10 years to do what can be done in a moment. But this story comes to show us it need be this way. And this chapter comes to tell us, if you know what the determinants are, you can convert 13 years of life exile in the forest into 13 days, as Krishna told Yudhishthira. That's the knowledge he's offering us in the chapter. It's not theoretical knowledge. It's very practical. And Satchidananda is an infinite existence, an infinite conscious existence. And he says, this infinite existence expresses itself as three spiritual determinants. Known in the tradition, it says Brahman, it should be Atman here, but he uses both. Atman, Purusha, Ishvara. That's how we know them in the tradition. Described in English, there is the ultimate reality is a pure, infinite, silent self. Infinite and eternal. But that ultimate reality is also an infinite conscious being, seeing everything, watching everything, sanctioning everything. And that infinite reality, that infinite existence is also the Lord of all creation who's doing everything at every moment through his Shakti. These are the three aspects of reality. There is no other reality. The real reality is an infinite consciousness, an infinite being, a total being that transcends the entire universe but has become the whole universe and is governing the whole universe. And the next chapter, which may in some sense be the heart of the whole book, is about Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti, where he tells the whole chapter he devotes to explaining to us what are the cosmic determinants that come from these three. He is going to explain in detail. We can't do it all in this chapter. It's too much. He's going to explain in detail how everything we experience in the world is the result of these aspects of the infinite existence. So this is the first step, the first line of determination. The officers that Satchidananda sends forth into the universe that are determining everything. Existence, consciousness, bliss, delight, the seat, Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, knowledge and will, beauty, love and joy. Everything else. Everything that we know, everything that exists in the universe comes from these nine. But he goes further. He says, each of these nine immediately becomes three. The nine becomes 27. Because in the supermind, each of these cosmic spiritual determinants has three aspects. In the supermind, everything is one. No subject, there's no object in the comprehending supermind. But in the apprehending supermind, each of these becomes three. So love, the spiritual determinant of love, it expresses as the lover. Darcy's the lover. He's the subject. The object of love, Elizabeth, she's the beloved. The experience that relates them together, which is his love for her, of love. If love is to manifest in the universe, it not only needs to somebody to love, there must be something to love. There must be an object. There must be an experience of love. In this story, the real love is Darcy's love of Elizabeth. He is the lover. He feels the love. She's the object of the love. That's what we see. There's the delight, joy. If there's delight, there must be somebody who enjoys. There must be something that we enjoy. And there's the act of enjoyment. So delight becomes three. Beauty. If beauty is there, there must be something to experience the beauty, to see the beauty. There must be something that's beautiful. Whether it's a person or a flower or a sunset or whatever, or a thought or a feeling. And there is the experience, which we've all know how wonderful to feel that beauty, to perceive beauty. So each of these becomes multiple. And then it gets much more complicated. Each of these combines with one another. These 27 combine with each other in so many combinations. So when the will is there, and when the knowledge is there, and it's a knowledge of truth, it becomes goodness. When there's a will combined with truth, it becomes goodwill. Each of these combines to create others, and they combine to create others until we have all the spiritual values that govern the universe. And it is these spiritual values that are determining the evolution of the universe. They are not just high ideals. They're powers. They're not just things, yes, as there's no for honesty on earth. Real truthfulness is the highest, greatest power in the world, greater than anything else. And this story really illustrates how powerful these spiritual determinants and cosmic determinants are, because every character that achieves by aligning themselves with the spiritual determinant. And that's the secret for us. He says, if we want to understand reality, we can say that the ultimate truth, the ultimate determinant, is the source of all positive determinants, which is what I just said. Ultimately, the divine absolute is the source of all determinants. It's the self that becomes all things. It's the source of all qualities in the universe, the Saguna Brahman. Infinite qualities. It's the one who becomes the many. It's the infinite personality, infinite person that becomes all persons, including us, and all personalities in the universe. They all come from the infinite person. The Lord of creation that is behind all works. And as in the tradition, it's that which being known, all is known. If we know that Brahman, we know essentially everything there is to know. This is what he called the fundamental affirming positives. The truth of the universe is the real source of the universe. That which is trying to work itself out in the evolution are these affirming positives. But that's not all the divine is. That's not all. That's not the whole truth of the absolute. The absolute is also indeterminable. In the tradition, the Brahman is ineffable, indefinable, unknowable. Sri Aurobindo says it can be known. It can be known by all of these positive aspects, but it can never be fully known by them Because the divine, the absolute, is not limited to any aspects or even the sum of all aspects. The divine is not the opposite of all these things. The absolute is greater than all these things. It is so free that it's even free from the limitations of being Satchitananda. It's even free from the limitations of simply being love and beauty and joy and knowledge and truth. It's something incomparably greater than that. So in the tradition they say, the absolute is indeterminable, it's unknowable. Meaning, no amount of description, explanation, or experience can exhaust the unknowableness of the infinite. So, the infinite can also be described in negative terms that appear to be the opposite of the positive terms. And he calls these the fundamental negative positives. They're not the negative negatives. They're the negative positives in the sense that they free the positives of their limitations. Even if you say the divine is infinite and eternal and freedom and peace and silence or power, it's not limited to any of those descriptions. It's not limited. You say the divine is the creator of the universe, yes, but the divine is also an unchanging, immutable, eternal self that's far beyond the universe, that need not be thinking about a universe, because it's infinite and eternal. And if it's creating the universe, at the same time, it's equally capable of just being so many other things. It is the Nirguna Brahman, which is beyond any characteristic, any quality. It's indescribable. We can't even say it's beauty, love, and joy. It's beyond all qualities. It's pure oneness, not differentiated, not divided. It's not only an infinite person, it's infinite personality, infinite impersonality. It's beyond even the limits of a person that can be described as a person. It's not only infinite activity, it's a silence behind, beyond all activity. It's unknowable and ineffable. The origin of the world we live in, the real source of the cosmic determinations, is something so infinite, so powerful, so unimaginably full of qualities that nothing can limit it. No description, positive or negative. It doesn't mean the divine is the opposite of all the positives. It's simply beyond description by all positives. So when we say, what is this universe about? What is possible? What can we achieve? There's no limit to what this world will become, to what this cosmic spiritual evolution will become, to what our souls can manifest. Because essentially, we are an embodiment of an indeterminable infinite that can be anything it wants and everything it wants. There is no limit. And that means our lives. Our lives can be anything we want to be. There's no limit. There's the limit that we pose by our thoughts, by our feelings, by our preferences, by saying she's tolerable or you must marry Collins or any other scheming or plots or anything that our egos do. We are setting the limits on our own infinite manifestation. That's why when Morris Goodman died, that he must walk out of there and he will walk out within a year, he does walk out within a year because he believed it was possible. He didn't set a limit on what it's possible for him to do and to be. He says, this omnipresent reality that is expressing as the universe is behind everything. It is the source of the superconscient heavens, where the yogi goes into a luminous trance of pure self-awareness, of pure light and bliss and oneness, and forgets the world. It is also the source of the dark inconscient, in which there seems to be no life or no consciousness at all, which is really a trance of the divine concealing itself, involving itself for the joy of coming out. But there inside, there's nothing that is not divine in its essence. It's the source of the ignorance, the world we live in. But this ignorance is not a permanent feature of the universe. It's a play, it's a movement, it's temporary, it's got a direction. It's going like the story of Pride and Prejudice from beginning to end. It has an intention, there's a story, there's a plot, there's a consummation. There's something to be sought and discovered and won. And that's what this world is, an evolution of the divine, a manifestation for the joy of creative self-expression. A manifestation in which we are to acquire greater and greater knowledge and greater self-awareness and greater power and greater delight of existence as we evolve. Everything is explained by these origins. And in the following chapters, he's going to go through and explain what is the superconscient, what is the inconscient? What is the ignorance? He's going to go through in great detail. This is only the beginning. This is only the first chapter. He's going to explain exactly how the ignorance is created, what it is, why falsehood comes, why evil comes, conflict comes. He's going to reveal all of it. But this is the essential foundation for all that he's going to explain. And he says that in the tradition is so strongly convinced that the ultimate reality is featureless, empty oneness. That even if this is accepted, they will say, but ultimately, if you go far enough, you'll end up with a nothingness, right? Sri Aurobindo says, ultimately, when you go far enough, you will end up with something that's indescribable but capable of everything. The absolute at its highest level is not an infinite emptiness. It's an infinite potential that can't be described by any positive or any negative. They say, well, what about this supermind? Obviously, supermind is only a limited view. When we get to Satchitananda, then all of the manifestation that supermind creates, all of the real ideas, everything will disappear, right? We'll only be in a oneness. He says, supermind is the power of Satchitananda. The potentialities of supermind are there in Satchitananda. Satchitananda is not an emptiness. It's an infinite power and capacity. Supermind is its power. You may go to a point in your experience where instead of seeing a million determinants, you see only the pure existence, consciousness, bliss. But all the power is there, is concealed in there. Even if you go beyond that to the highest truths of the absolute, all this is there implicit. This divine reality is not an infinite emptiness. It's an infinite power. It's an infinite potentiality to be anything it wants to be. This is the ultimate determinant of the universe. Behind us, is not a limitation. Our destiny is not to settle for, like Charlotte, well, I'm 27, I have no degree, I'm a plain looking girl, this is all I can, I'll take it and I'll be happy. That's all I can get. This is the best I can get. There is no best for us. There is no limit for us except the limit we set. If we want to do like Charlotte or anybody else, that's our prerogative, that's our choice. But there is no limit to what the cosmic spiritual determinants are offering us. So what does all this have to do with the story? What can we learn in the story? What do we see in the story? If you look carefully, every outcome in the story is expressing these spiritual determinants. I mentioned a few of them already. Darcy, it's love that is manifesting in Darcy's life. It's the sincerity of knowledge that's manifesting in his life. In Elizabeth, it's her sincerity, it's her cheerfulness, it's her courage, it's her goodwill for Jane. For Charlotte, it's the power of goodwill to Jane and Elizabeth that helps her marry Collins. For Mr. Bennett, it's his sense of honor, not what's imposed on him, but what he imposes on himself as a consciousness responsibility that determines the outcome. For him, Bingley's rewarded for his patience and his humility, for accepting what's imposed on him happily, quietly, but never giving up his love for Jane. Gardeners are rewarded for their spiritual refinement, for their goodwill, and never ask anything for themselves, and they become close friends of Darcy and constant visitors at Pemberley. So to me, this story has a very great personal message. All of these spiritual determinants are there in our lives. We can always be more sincere. We can always seek goodwill. Self-giving, truthfulness. These are not high principles that are hanging over us like a threat or a demand from above. These are the powers of the infinite that want to express in our lives. And if you want to know which is the road that takes you to Pemberley and which is the road that takes us in the other direction, they're the signs. At every minute, if I'm seeking the joy of being angry at somebody, being important and asserting on somebody or triumphing over somebody, I can know for sure I'm going in the wrong direction. I'm going, if I want to enjoy, that's the taste of ignorance. If I really want to experience the spiritual determinants in my life, being good, practicing self-giving, being true, taking responsibility, frightening. Who wants to take responsibility the way Mr. Bennett did? My God, it's difficult enough as it is. You want all of this sacrifice? I didn't ask the foolish girl to elope, and I never said I would pay all of this money. He's got more money. He can do it. Why should I do it? If he does it, he gets the benefit. If Mr. Gardner pays that money, he gets the benefit. If Mr. Bennett decides to pay that money, has the sincerity to pay that money, there's no money to be paid. What is needed is sincerity. The price is sincerity. The price is not £6,000 or £8,000. The price that life is asking of him is be sincere, and you get your sincerity is worth £8,000. You don't have to spend a peso. If Darcy wants to be happy, the price for him is to be good, to be humble, to be generous, to think of other people and work for their happiness. So this chapter, I think, has a great practical message for all of us. When mother holds up high ideals and Appa's listing is, this is the way you can do this and that. Oh, so many disciplines. It looks very painful. What a sacrifice we have to make. It's not a sacrifice. They're all sugar pills. What we think is bitter medicine, this is the fastest way to get from Longbourn to Pemberley. You want to go the long route? You can go in the opposite direction. If you go far enough south, you'll ultimately end up at Chennai from Pondicherry or at Delhi. But you have to go a long, long way if you want to go in the other direction in order to get there. Instead of that, there's a shortcut. This is the map. There's a shortcut from the past to the future, from where we are to a better future, and the signposts are clear. They're the spiritual determinants. And at each moment, we know. If we want to know, we can know what it is to be sincere, what it is to be good, what it is to practice self-giving. This is to flow with the river. Then it's not by our own effort that we go there. The river is going there. And the river's flowing much faster than any of us can swim. And it will carry us forward. I'd like to open it up for questions. Ashok, thanks for questions in advance. Go ahead, please.
Integral yoga. Surrender of the ego has been made a very important condition for progress in sadhana. Now it occurs to me that it is very unlikely that ego itself will volunteer for surrender. That would amount to committing suicide or something. So if ego is not willing to surrender, the only other option is that the psychic takes charge of the personality, brings the ego under its control, then asks the ego to do surrender. But that's also, I think, is very unlikely because ego is not something that so easily comes under the control of the psychic. It's neither the ego willing to surrender on its own, neither ego coming under the control of the psychic to, neither control, coming under the control of the psychic and agreeing to surrender, then how else do we affect the surrender of the ego? Sadhana is my question.
Very good question. As you say, there's no likelihood that the ego is going to surrender itself. Mother says the ego is a great charlatan. The ego is the criminal who offers to be the guard at the bank to make sure that nobody comes and steals the money. It's not that the ego is to surrender itself. It's when we reach the psychic will surrender and dissolve the ego. The ego wants its own accomplishment in fulfillment. But what does this chapter tell us? Everything the ego really wants, I mean, if it wants things positively, it will get more of by giving itself up. Every positive thing that the ego wants can be better fulfilled by surrendering itself. Because the ego wants to be infinitely powerful. But as a separate being, it can never be infinitely powerful. And the more it achieves, the more it will fail. And the opposition it will get from life. It can only become infinitely powerful by becoming an infinite being. It becomes an infinite being by moving from ego to psychic, which is infinite and eternal. If the ego seeks happiness, the fullest happiness that we're capable of, a non-stop happiness at all times, is only there in the psychic. It's only by self-giving and goodwill that Darcy finds happiness in life, not by the assertion of his self-importance and his ego. So it turns out the ego is only a temporary phenomenon created in the evolution of consciousness. When the ego becomes enlightened, it discovers that its best interest is in giving itself up and getting to the psychic. Its best interest is doing not what will serve itself, but being in tune with these spiritual determinants. And the method for that is consecration. When the ego agrees, I've got a problem, I want to overcome that problem for my own egoistic relief or progress, the formula is consecrate it to Mother. What does it mean to consecrate the problem to Mother? It means to give up my egoism. If Darcy says, I'm lonely, there's nobody to take care of my sister, I'm afraid, I'm tired of hearing the flattering of Carolyn, there must be something more in life. I have nothing I can do with all this money. Yes, you consecrate your sense of self-importance. You consecrate your selfishness. You consecrate your superiority. You give up. You consecrate your boorish, offensive behavior. You try to be sweet and true and good and generous and help others, meaning you move from the ego to the psychic and you will get everything you now long for. We think we long for the fulfillment of the ego. What we really long for is to move from the ego to the psychic. What we really long for is an infinite joy, an infinite love, an infinite beauty, and an infinite knowledge, which can only come when we give up the ego. It's our mistake to think that our fulfillment comes from the fulfillment of the ego. When we look in the story, we see it's very clear to us in the story, if only it were that clear in our own lives. Every character who acts for their own egoistic, selfish fulfillment ends up only in trouble. And every time a character moves away from the ego and accepts a higher principle for its conduct and fulfillment, they make a progress. We don't get our fulfillment by trying to fulfill our ego. That's what Lady Catherine did. That's what Mrs. Bennett did. She tried to get her fulfillment by triumphing over Lady Lucas. What's the idea of Jane marrying Bingley unless I can act superior to Lady Lucas and make her feel small? She found out every time she does that, we say shooting herself in the foot. She was her own worst enemy. No, it's very clear in the story. Mrs. Bennett was her own worst enemy. Her aspiration is true. All her actions by the ego only canceled her own opportunities. That's true for all of us.
You say, Mr. Bennett, made great progress when he accepted to repay the loan that he owed to Mr. Gardiner. And that the nominal commitment to repay the loans at once brought a lot of grace into his life and got three of his daughters married at without any expense on his part. Now, very often I hear Appa saying that people who don't come forward to clear the loans that they have taken, they cannot come up in life,
yes,
however hard they may try. Now, why does he say that when you don't clear loans that you owe, you cannot come up in life? Logically speaking, people who don't clear loans that they owe to others, they are actually saving a lot of money. So all that money is the extra bonus for them. But Appa says actually those people, they can't come up in life till their loans are cleared. He seems to be referring to some law that he alone understands.
But you say you see the truth of it in the story. Mr. Bennett illustrates the truth of this principle, no?
He was not forced, nor was he compelled. It was his own decision.
Yes.
But just taking a nominal decision, life responded so magnificently.
Yes. So what did that show? His sincerity of decision, or rather his sense of consciousness responsibility, was worth £8,000, much more than £8,000, let's be clear. Lizzie Wickham was paid, we don't know exactly, but by any calculation, it's at least £6,000 or £8,000. Not only that, Jane marries Bingley and gets $5,000 a year income. Lizzie marries Darcy and gets $10,000 a year. What is the story needed for Jane and Lizzie to qualify normally to marry these people? At least some £50,000 between them would have been a minimum amount. So Carolyn was worth about £30,000, I think, or Georgiana was worth about £30,000. So even if you take it conservatively, the money that he did not have to pay for Lydia's wedding and the dowry for Jane and Lizzie, at least you can say £50,000-£60,000. Fitzwilliam said the price, the dowry for him, he's an Earl's second son, he has no money. He's worth £50,000 in the dowry market, one man. So definitely Darcy and Bingley, who have property, even though they don't have that, they're not the Earl's second son, they're worth at least £50,000 or £100,000. So what does it mean? It means consciousness responsibility. His sincerity of truthfulness and consciousness responsibility is worth to him, practically, not theoretically, is worth practically £50,000 to £100,000. So what does it mean to come up? The man who says, I'm not going to pay Wickham, fortunately, Gardner has done it, I can save £6,000. Actually, what he loses is £60,000. The value to him of not having to pay is he gets the bare minimum that Lydia is saved from permanent ruin. The value of his deciding to pay is he gets the equivalent of £50,000 or £100,000. What is his own life? What happens to him? He rises up. He becomes a regular visitor at Pemberley. His whole life rises to a much higher level. We can't put a price on it. He himself rises to a whole higher level of society. The whole family rises. You can't put a price on it. That price comes because of his consciousness responsibility. So you're looking at it in terms of how much I can save by not paying the debt. We must look at how much he would have lost by taking the normal human action. He loses his whole future. He loses a destiny 10 times greater than what he has himself. That's the power of the spiritual determinant. You saw that a spiritual determinant, the right spiritual attitude, is worth 10 times the price. That was true in his life also. The right attitude is worth 10 times or 50 or 100 times. We can't put a price on it, but we see a pinnacle of the multiplier. The right attitude, the right sincerity is worth an infinitely more than any benefit, any material benefit we get. Mrs. Bennett wanted Lizzie to marry Collins because he probably has an income of 800 or 1,000 pounds, and ultimately he'll get the entail for another 2,000 pounds. What is Darcy compared to that? And what is Bingley and Jane compared to that? That would have been the most foolish compromise if Lizzie and Mr. Bennett had gone along with him. That's the minimum that the family could get. Now the whole family is elevated, and the whole future of the family for future generations is on a new course. The whole family's been elevated. Instead of, they would have been degraded by bringing, if they had chosen Collins. Okay, no other questions? Quiet group today. Thanks, Ashok. Your question.
I have one more question for you.
Yes.
See, if this argument of yours is right, say let us take the case of Britain and India. For 100 years, Britain has exploited India, used their resources and material resources as well as human labor. I would say Britain owes a lot of money by way of this exploitation. There is no talk of Britain repaying all that it has taken away from India. But I don't find the unpaid owes affecting British prosperity in anything. Fact that for 100 years Britain has exploited India, maybe if you calculate in monetary terms, it may run into a huge bill. Neither India is claiming it nor Britain offering to pay back all that it has taken away from India. But right or wrong, it is in no way affecting British prosperity. That goes on undisturbed. How do you explain 100 years of exploitation that is not even being compensated?
Well,
this is monumental in the.
It's a very resourceful question. I'd like to answer it in two ways. One is to challenge the assumption, and the other is to agree with the assumption and answer it. I think to say that Britain has fully exploited India is a gross oversimplification. It's India that fully exploited itself and reduced itself to impoverishment long before the British ever came. And you know the story very well. It's the quarreling Indian Rajas who invited the British in for their own interest. It's not England in here and tried to conquer India. The country was handed over in the eagerness by the Indians themselves. And what is the higher spiritual truth in that, and what India gets from it, and what England gets from it? That's a very good topic for further discussion. I think that's a greater truth than the other side of it. But for the moment, with that clarification, let me accept your interpretation. Sri Aurobindo has written that there was a possibility of forming world government before World War I. If England had converted the Commonwealth into a world government, meaning if England had voluntarily given up its colonies in trying to expand the largest empire that ever existed into the first world government, what would be England's position today in the world? They would have been founders of the world government. What is England's position in the world today? You have to remember, 100 years ago, they were the most powerful nation in the whole world. When we were running the International Commission on Peace and Food, you remember, I made the mistake of referring to England as a tiny island, and an Englishman in the room was offended. What do you mean a tiny island? Because today, that's what we think of England. England is a tiny, nobody thinks of England in the world today, seriously. If it's some prosperity, it has the same prosperity as other European nations, no more. Even less than Ireland, which it subjected. And in the future, what's its future destiny? Its future destiny is to be one of the also-rans in the world. It missed its opportunity. So you think that of what it has, and it hasn't been punished. If it could have been in America today, if it could have been the America of today, the U.S. has that opportunity to found the world government today. If it doesn't, what will be its position 100 years from now compared to China and India, if presuming that China or India rises to the occasion and doesn't miss the opportunity as well? You should look in terms of what it lost. As the U.S. looks back and reveres Abraham Lincoln 150 years ago as the greatest American that ever lived and saved the country, and the blacks everywhere have been inspired by him, what would it be if the world today recognized the unique contribution of England towards world unity? They would be worshipped and revered by the world. Nobody takes England seriously today, and in the future, it's only going to go down more relatively. If England is not directly punished, if they're not going to go directly into the sea, which Mother indicates a possibility, if they're saved from that, it's because they've not only done bad things, they've done good things. It's not a record one way or the other. Even if Mr. Bennett had not paid Wickham, he still got a benefit. Had not taken that responsibility, he still would have been saved from catastrophe, because in many other respects, he's a positive person. He's an honest person. He was a good father. So it's not black or white. The point is, he had an opportunity to make a progress. He chose to make that progress and ended up with 10 times more than what he had before. So rather than say, why hasn't England suffered and been punished by it, and it's where could they have been and what could they be today in the world if they had made the same decision? In fact, let's be fair. Which empire in the history of the world has ever given up its possessions voluntarily? England did it. Are they not being rewarded for that? They didn't fight India to the end. They gave up their colonies peacefully, willingly. They did to do it. It was not a revolution that was fought. Could they have done more? Certainly. And Sri Aurobindo has told us what would have been, what was the higher opportunity that they missed. And because they've missed that, they will settle for being one of the also-rans. Nobody thinks today of Greece. Greece was the greatest civilization in the world at that time. Egypt was. Who thinks of them today? We don't take them seriously. So it doesn't mean they're all washed out. It means they get what everybody else. So England is getting what everybody else in Europe is getting today, not something extraordinary. That's the price. The price, the divine is not here to punish people. The divine is here to manifest infinity. If we choose to be what we are and stay where we are, then we get what everybody gets. We get Collins instead of Darcy. We get Hunsford instead of Pemberley. You're not Collins. Charlotte's not punished for that. She misses a higher opportunity. The evolution is not a punishment. It's not for the good and the bad. We're all divine. And to question whether we're going to be the leaders and manifest that power, or are we going to be the followers and get what everybody else gets as we go along? A very good thought-provoking question. Okay, Ashok? I take that as a okay.
First, I am giving special thanks to Mr. Gary on behalf of all senders and all devotees. இவ்வளவு நல்ல ஒரு டாபிக்க எல்லாருக்கும் புரியற மாதிரி சிம்பிளா சீப் இல்லா நிச்சயமா அவர் கொடுத்துட்டார். அப்பா எழுதுற மாதிரி நம்மளுக்கு கேட்கறது முக்கியம் இல்ல, புரிவதும் முக்கியம். ஏதாவது ஒரு விஷயத்தையாவது நம்ம லைஃப்ல அப்ளை பண்ணறதுதான் முக்கியம். அதுதான் இதுல இருந்து நம்மளுக்கு வர மெசேஜ். அதை நாம புரிஞ்சுட்டு அப்ளை பண்ண தொடங்கினா நிச்சயமா அவர் சொல்ற அந்த பிராஸ்பரிட்டிக்கு நம்ம வர முடியும் என்று கூறி, வணக்கம் கூறி, நன்றி கூறி விடை பெறுகிறோம். வணக்கம்.